Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be able to come to the Massachusetts Historical Society to talk about the Prudential Center, to talk about my book, Insuring the City, and to tell this story really to a hometown crowd. I mean, nothing may be more obvious to you to write a book about the Prudential Center. There it is, this incredible place that you think about, obviously, every day in some ways. But I had to go explain this to architectural historians and urban historians. Why the Prudential Center? Why would this building and its surrounds, why would this landscape make such a good story for an architectural historian who would usually be taking on projects about buildings with some kind of reputation or some kind of fancy designer or something like that? I was looking for a story why I chose the Pru. I wanted to tell a story about the major shifts in American cities from the 19th century city, the industrial city, the city organized around railroads and steam power, to the 20th century city, the city of automobiles, and the city of the service economy, the post-industrial economy. I was looking for a story that would help crystallize this in some ways very anxious moment for so many American cities, including Boston, as they begin to make their way out of the industrial period and into the post-industrial world. This is very much the case with the Prudential Center, which is built over a rail yard right here in the Back Bay. And of course, it is the railroads that are creating the Back Bay in the first place. Before it's filled in, those railroads are trundling across the old marshland on these viaducts, and it's the railroads that are themselves involved with so much of filling in that land. The land in the Back Bay that would become the Prudential Center was originally, the very first making of that land, a rail yard for the Boston and Albany Railroad, which when the Prudential Center, which when Prudential bought it in the 1950s, was owned by the New York Central Railroad, then run by Robert Young, who's an important player in mid-century corporate history. So this shift between the city organized around the railroad and the city organized around highways. And from the very beginning, the Prudential Center was organized very tightly with the Massachusetts Turnpike, the urban extension of the Mass Pike. The two projects were planned together, they were engineered together, they were designed together. Politically, they were entirely linked, as I'll talk about a little bit further, and they were even financed together in some sense. For example, or importantly, I should say, Prudential ended up purchasing more than a quarter of the bonds floated by the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority to build the extension. So in some sense, Prudential paid for its own driveway into these ramps that were there before the Copley Center was placed on top of them that fed its own garages. I was interested in the Prudential Center, too, because it tells a slightly different story about urban renewal and post-war urban redevelopment than we're used to. And I'll tell a little bit more about that more conventional narrative, because, of course, we have urban redevelopment along those lines in Boston as well. But what I was interested in was how corporations became the patrons, the sponsors of the new landscapes of the post-war American city. So much of the story of urban redevelopment is based around using the Housing Acts of 1949 and then 1954 to essentially label parts of the city as slums or blight or obsolescent areas, and to use federal funding to write down the cost of its destruction and demolition. And this happened, of course, in cities across the United States, and it happened in Boston, too, along those lines. What architectural and urban historians pay less attention to are how corporations exert their own ideas about the new city and implement their own policies, corporate policies, in deciding how that new world, how that new city would take place. And in Boston, we have a very powerful corporation at work, the Prudential Insurance Company, based in Newark, New Jersey, represented here by its president, Carol Shanks. This is Mayor John Hines, the mayor that would come to assume power after James Michael Curley. I was also interested in post-war architectural culture. When we talk about the post-war urban landscape and modern architecture of the 50s and 60s, we're often talking about, at least architectural historians, certain buildings that have entered the canon of modernist architecture. They're interesting buildings, they're good buildings that have got distinction. right? And the architects themselves have their own stories. They came from Germany to teach at the GSD, people like Walter Gropius, who I'll mention later in this talk as well. That's generally the way architectural historians have dealt with mid-century architecture. I was interested in looking at the culture of architectural production from that time period. And to do so, there was no better firm than the firm of Charles Luckman. Charles Luckman, whose firm was the head architect for the Prudential Center, extremely prolific firm in the 1950s. I like to say the most important architect you've never heard of, built a huge amount of work during that time period. Originally, he was paired with William Pereira, who, I should say, for you architectural historians or buffs out there, has got distinction. His reputation has actually been revived as a designer. And their roles, when they were partners in the first 8 years of the 1950 and 58, was very clear. Pereira wore the smock. He was the artist, the designer. Luckman was the businessman, shirt sleeves rolled up, pipe in his mouth, reviewing the different plans. I like this, I don't like that. Sitting at his desk like a kind of executive. Very much like the kind of practice he would come to run. And then let me come back to this point, why the Prudential Center, why an architectural historian would be interested in the Prudential Center. I have to tell you, it wasn't just my rebellious spirit that made me pick it, because it's not considered good architecture. I like the fact that it was considered bad architecture. If the Prue was considered good architecture, it might actually distract us in some ways from some of the important stories of urban change in the 1950s. So there it is, the Prudential Center. This landscape that it was up to me in some ways, or my mission, my goal, to unravel the forces that had produced it, and in doing so, take a boring building and make it into the most interesting building you'd ever heard about or ever read about. And that's really my mission in this talk, and I'll do my best to deliver on that. And to say this too, the attitude towards the built environment, to architecture, to the public spaces that are produced around it, to the roads and the system of roads. From the beginning, there was a ring road that circumnavigated the site. As I said before, the urban extension of the pipe runs literally right through it to connect to the central artery. It's to see this as a cultural landscape, to see it in its entirety. Not to take just the tower as a piece of design, not just to take the road, but to look at it as a complete picture, as a cultural landscape, and again, to unravel the forces of its production. Now, and really, let me say this too. This is maybe a little bit of jargon, but I'll give it to you anyway. It's to think about the discourses materialize in this site. In other words, in this one place, there are many different stories, many different conversations that flow through it. And there they are, crystallized at different moments in time. And as you'll see, and as you know, the Prudential Center has been a very restless landscape. In fact, it's almost always been a construction site since the moment that it was put up. It's barely ever remained very still for very long. So it gets remade at many different times. But in each moment, there are stories, there are discourses that materialize, that appear in this physical landscape. And that is sort of my approach as an architectural and urban historian. One of the discourses materialized, one of the key stories that we have to understand when we're going to talk about the Prudential Center, is patronage and power. The role of insurance companies in making architecture and making urban landscapes. You cannot tell the story of American architectural history without talking about the insurance company. They are there every step of the way, commissioning important buildings and making key contributions to the buildings in which they are located. And these are just a few examples, and I want to situate the Prudential in this kind of conversation here. I'm going to briefly go through them. For example, in the 1860s and 70s, post-war, just after the Civil War, insurance, life insurance, becomes a very popular product, partly inspired by the kind of intense morbidity of the Civil War. And life insurance companies everywhere were booming. Some of these companies were very young, like the Equitable Life Insurance Company in New York, which had just formed really in the early 1850s, I should say. By the 1860s, they're already running an architectural competition to design what would become, it's no longer there, it was destroyed and replaced by other buildings, it's another story. But they were already having competition to commission what would become an important building to anchor New York's central business district down there on lower Broadway and lower Manhattan, and to be a sign that the company could be trusted, that by commissioning such an impressive piece of architecture, it was secure, that the product that it was selling, financial security, which is sort of floating out there in some sense, could be counted on. So from the beginning, insurance companies have had an important relationship to buildings as a way to validate the product that they're selling. And again, these are buildings that are coming from the discourse of architectural history as important and interesting buildings, bringing the Second Empire style, for example, that had been used for Napoleon's additions to the Louvre in Paris, becoming a very kind of stylish, cosmopolitan architectural style, now being brought to the United States, to American cities. Or consider the Home Life Insurance Company's building in Chicago. Now, bear in mind, it's not just headquarters structures that insurance companies are building. As they grow and as their clientele grows, insurance companies, they naturally have this kind of imperial instinct, in fact. They need to grow. They need more policyholders to collect more premiums, right? In order for them to then turn around and make investments themselves. And I'll talk more about that as a business model too. So they would build branch offices. The Home Life Insurance Company is a New York company, and they would go to Chicago and build what some architectural historians have called the first skeleton frame skyscraper, because the whole thing was made out of an iron skeleton, and everything you see that looks so solid off of the masonry, well, that's really not holding the building up. So for architectural historians, this is a very important building designed by William LeBaron Jenney. Or take MetLife, really Prue's number one competitor in the 1950s and 60s and onward. In 1909, they built this miraculous tower, still a landmark in New York by Napoleon Lebrun, and they would use the tower itself in so many of their advertisements as the light that never fails. Now, one of the things that MetLife is doing here is drawing on civic iconography to establish themselves as an important institution in the town. In this case, drawing from ecclesiastical imagery, right? This is from the Campanile in Venice, from really church architecture. Just the way this was drawing from sort of imperial architecture in Paris. Now, another thing about MetLife that's so important, it's not just this impressive tower that's considered such an interesting piece of architecture. It's also the location. Because what MetLife has done is left its digs down there in lower Manhattan and pioneered a new business district by Madison Square Park. And what they're saying is this. Not only are we going to commission a fancy architect to build a fantastic tower, but we don't even need downtown. We're going to leave it behind. We have the fiscal confidence to pioneer a whole new business district in the city. They've been assembling land there as early as the 1880s and 90s. That's also MetLife, before they would build the tower. Let's go to Hartford for a minute. In some ways, Boston's chief competitor for a while, at least in the 1950s, for being the most important financial center in New England. That's right, Hartford was going to compete with Boston at that time. And they had many, many insurance companies, as you well know. One of their important buildings from the 1920s was Aetna's headquarters, designed by James Gamble Rogers. And Yale alumni will know James Gamble Rogers because he is he's the brilliant architect who designed Yale's major expansion from 1917 all the way through the 1930s. What does he do for Aetna? He essentially builds a Yale College. For those of you who've been to New Haven, this is very much like Timothy Dwight College. He builds a kind of Georgian mansion, not in downtown Hartford, but up the street a little ways in a midtown location, expressing in some ways the same kind of confidence that MetLife did when they moved to a midtown location, to say, we don't need downtown, we can handle our own business all in this massive Georgian mansion, and we're going to locate outside of downtown. Now, this was taken to the next degree by Connecticut General, another Hartford company in the 1950s, when they left the city altogether for the suburbs and built what has, in fact, come to stand as one of the highlights, in some sense, of post-war corporate modernist architecture. This is considered a good building in terms of, on strictly architectural terms, designed by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill as a kind of lateral rendering of the new office floor for the production of insurance companies with this extremely taut glass curtain wall. And what they're saying in the same ways along this trajectory is they are using the power of patronage to patronize an important new building, and they're also championing a whole new model for the post-war city, to leave it entirely, to go out to the suburbs, a place organized around highways, a real threat, a threat to the integrity of the central business district as the most important place. I'm putting Prudential right in the middle of all this. And what does Prudential want to do in Boston, and as we'll see in other places? They want it both ways. They're hedging their bets. They want a big, midtown, campus-like environment that they can control, a place that will have a lot of access to the car, but they're not willing to give up the tradition of distinction, really, or the tradition of prominence of a downtown tower. They want a tower, and they also want a kind of quasi-suburban campus. So whether or not the PRU is considered to be in the same discourse or the same kind of canon of architectural history, it fits right in there between the post-war suburban landscapes, the 1920s midtown landscapes, and the real urban architecture of the 19th century. Now, we see the same pattern here in Boston, actually, the same kind of flow from the central business district downtown out towards midtown locations. After the fire of 1871 that destroyed so much of Boston's central business district, it's insurance companies that step into the breach to commission the first important new buildings after the fire, again, to show their confidence that Boston would remain an important city. There's a local company, New England Mutual, right here, and then kind of outdone in some sense by their New York rival, New York Mutual, which puts up this nice tower here, right on Post Office Square. They're all clustering around the new federal post office and courthouse that was, again, commissioned by the U.S. government out of Washington. They're building there on Post Office Square. And the insurance companies join the federal government to create a new business district in what we now consider to be downtown Post Office Square as a financial district. At that time, was already spreading out from State Street, which had been the traditional central business district. Even Post Office Square was spreading out a little bit. Now, the next round of investment in office buildings in Boston is also coming from insurance companies, and we see them following the same trend as Aetna and Hartford, and even in Metropolitan Life as well, looking for bigger plots of land to build more impressive and larger structures to house their growing operations, and they move to the Back Bay. And there are important commissions as early as 1922, that's the front building still there, still standing, from John Hancock. Liberty Mutual has a dull little box back here in 1937. New England Mutual hires Cram and Ferguson, that's Ralph Adams Cram's firm, to build the Liberty Mutual building here. They put a big addition on it in the early 60s, so you can't really get the same sense of the tower. This is now more of a sheer wall. And then what really was, for a very long time, and in some ways maybe still is, Boston's most sort of elegant tower is the John Hancock Tower of 1947, also designed by Cram and Ferguson, which becomes the de facto architectural firm behind so much of Boston's insurance architecture. And you see them there too, these companies flowing out from the center of the city and championing a new business district. This would be important when Prudential looked at Boston, because Midtown and the Back Bay had already been established as the location for the insurance companies. Now let's look at the business model here for a second. Why are these insurance companies so powerful? Why are they so prosperous? And the business model is a very, very simple one. That the breadwinner, and again, this is a very kind of gender discourse. The clients we're looking for are mostly men. They are the breadwinners, and the idea is that if you are a father, you are not performing your moral duty if you do not have life insurance, because you're not going to take care of little Susan after you go. So the ads don't change very much for about 70 years. It's basically putting a guilt trip on dad, saying if you don't buy life insurance, then you're going to leave your family in the lurch. And it works, because in 1964, Fortune magazine reports that the three biggest companies in the world are AT&T, of course, the telephone company itself with its own imperial instincts to grow, MetLife, Prudential's top competitor, and Prudential. That's what Fortune reports in 1964. Though death may enter there, though sorrow be your share, it is much indeed when grief must be endured to think, despite the blow, how comforting to know we are insured. And that line from the 1890s, in some ways, sums up the business model of selling life insurance to so many people. Prudential is an interesting company because what they champion is something called industrial insurance. It's selling small policies to working class people in the growing cities, the growing industrial cities of the United States. This was a role that had been performed by, longer ago, by different kinds of guilds or collection societies or widows and orphans societies, for example. And in fact, Prudential's founder, a Yale dropout, I might say, John Fairfield Dryden, he has a missionary instinct to bring this kind of service to American cities. He really believes in the need for industrial life insurance. He sees it as an important social good. I don't question his sincerity. It turns out he becomes extremely wealthy and influential, even to become serve as a U.S. senator from New Jersey over the course of his career. And here again is the basic idea that an agent would walk door to door collecting these small policies from the householders, even as small as three cents a week. So from the beginning, Prudential and other industrial insurance and life insurance companies are really bound up with the growing city, literally pounding the pavements of the city, collecting money from their different policyholders and using it to grow their own business. And they would grow. Now, Prudential used not only architecture, but they also the Rock to advertise security. We all know that very well. In fact, it was already seeping into the public consciousness from a very early date, seen in a public school. Where is the Rock of Gibraltar? The bright voice says, in Newark, New Jersey. It is owned by the Prudential Insurance Company. Now, of course, the Rock of Gibraltar is a limestone monolith off of the tip of the Iberian Peninsula, but it had seeped enough into the consciousness of so many Americans that the Rock was then and still is, in some sense, associated with the Prudential. Now, they would use it in their advertisements, but in 1892, Prudential really would build a kind of Rock right there in downtown Newark, anchoring the business district on Broad Street, hiring George Post, who had worked on the Equitable Building, one of these very prolific and distinguished architects from that time, to design this massive kind of French chateau right there in the center of Newark. A sign of the company's success on one sense, and again, fiscal confidence on the other. And they would grow. Prudential would grow as they continued to sell their even 3 cents a week insurance companies. They build more and more buildings next to the original there on Broad Street in Newark. They would build a whole campus behind it, as I'll show you. They even considered building this massive tower inspired by the Venetian Campanile, but Prudential said that that's a little too far out for us. MetLife ended up building something quite like that. Although MetLife in 1928 considered building a 100-story tower. I mean, how's that for a successful company? Of course, the Depression hit, and they ended up building just the first 30 or so, or maybe 50 or so stories. So what we have there today, if you go to Madison Square Park, you'll see a 50-story base for what was supposed to have been a 100-story tower. Just an indication, my point here, of these growing companies and how their growth is reflected in their home offices, in their home office landscape. And by 1945, Prudential had this little warren of buildings right there on Broad Street in Newark. But there were problems. The company was getting too big. And first of all, frankly, main thing was it was stifling executive talent. They couldn't figure out who the real leaders were. They were lost in these buildings somewhere. Also, Prudential executives, the kind of corporate planning committee, said we're not close enough to our clientele. We're now everywhere across the United States and Canada, and yet we're out of touch with our clientele. What was the solution? Break it up. Take the home office and break it up into regional home offices. not just branch offices. Prudential and the others have had all this time branch offices, but sort of semi-autonomous insurance companies that were responsible for sales and, importantly, for investments. Because don't forget, the insurance companies are investing all of this money that they're collecting. That's how it's working for them. In regions all over the country. Now, Prudential was so large that even these regional home offices in Los Angeles, Toronto, Houston, Jacksonville, Minneapolis, Chicago, and of course, finally Boston, which would become the Northeastern Home Office, really the last in this decentralization program, these were on their own probably the biggest insurance company in the region. That's how big Prudential was at that time. So it's important for us to see the proof right here in Boston as just one little outpost, one chip off the rock of this corporate decentralization program run out of a planning office in Newark. Okay? Corporate planners making this decision. And nothing says it better than this to me. Here's the new talent that's finally able to spread their wings and basically run their own small insurance company. And here are the physical manifestations of all of them. I'm going to take you quickly through a few of them to get a sense of how Prudential's architectural and geographical policies are playing out in these buildings. The first one is in Los Angeles, and we see these important trends, okay? As I mentioned before, Prudential wants to spread out. They want midtown locations. They do not want to be downtown. They don't want to get lost in the shuffle down there. They're concerned, frankly, about congestion and access, but they still want to have an impressive building that says Prudential emblazoned across the top, as you know, our own building does. So what do they do in Los Angeles? They go down Wilshire Boulevard. Already, this was the Miracle Mile, well-known in the 1920s for its department stores and as a place for shopping. Prudential pioneers the Miracle Mile or Wilshire Boulevard as an office district, as a new office landscape. And they hire Werdeman and Beckett, very outstanding architects from Los Angeles. In my opinion, if I'm looking at this from a kind of strictly aesthetic perspective, this is the nicest building, okay, in my opinion. Still there, although actually much messed around with ever since then. And it really is an urbane structure. Why? Because it addresses the street with street-level shopping. There's a department store, that's Orbach's department store from New York, their first West Coast location. And then all of the floors of Prudential offices. Not, I should say, built with speculative office space. This is just going to be filled up by Prudential. And there you see it really as a creature of its place on the strip on Wilshire Boulevard. Some of you may have learned to dance at Arthur Murray. They also have a presence there on the strip. There's the 1920s retail. And there's Prudential 1948. What a great building. I love this one. Then they go to Houston, the southwestern home office. Houston, people say, oh, this is the place with no zoning, there's no urban structure. Not so. In the 1920s, the oil companies were building very elegant Art Deco towers in downtown Houston. They were the main patrons of the office landscape in Houston. Prudential was offered a spot downtown, not interested. They want a big lot about 4 miles down Old Main Street near the Rice Institute, I might say. And this would become, partly due, I argue, because of Prudential's investment, an important new office node in what would become the polynucleated business landscape of the Houston area. They hire Kenneth Franzheim, actually a very interesting regional modernist architect who had worked quite a bit on some of the Art Deco towers downtown. And he builds this tower in 1952. Now this is interesting to me as well, because this is 1952, the same year as Lever House builds that glass shaft. But in 52, they really don't know what to do. They're looking back to Rockefeller Center, and I'll come back to that. That, for them, is the model of good business architecture. There are some Art Deco flourishes here, but it's basically a limestone building with somewhat awkward massing, again, speaking as an architectural critic in some ways. But what's important here, too, is the whole landscape. Parking, tennis courts, a swimming pool. In fact, Ovita Smith, Life called it a paradise for office girls. And Ovita Smith was willing to take a job at Prudential for less money than a competing insurance company because of all of the amenities the cafeteria, the swimming pool. It is a kind of post-war corporate welfare, part of the 19th century tradition of the corporation bringing amenities into the workplace to kind of keep the employees happy. And in this case, it paid off. Prudential said that all of these investments in the amenities very easily paid off on the retention of their employees because they liked working there so much. They went to Jacksonville. They built this incredible landscape across the St. John's River from downtown Jacksonville. I won't spend any time there because there's so many. But they finally come to Chicago, the Mid-America Home Office. This is an important building for Chicago. It is the first office building built since the Depression. It is a major shot in the arm for Chicago. It is a sign of confidence in the future of that city. And this becomes very key for Boston, which is similarly concerned about its post-war fate. So having the imprimatur of Prudential to say, we are investing in you, was a big deal. It was also a big deal because it was an air rights project built over the Illinois Central Railroad yards. So a lot of my information on the book about this comes from the real estate attorney. He wrote an essay on it called It Was a Lawyer's Dream. This project was a lawyer's dream because there was no template. There was no boilerplate you could use. Every kaizen dropped into the earth had to have its own negotiation worked out to figure out where it was. So the lawyers were loving it, and they built this incredible landscape. And now if you go to Chicago, all of this is filled in. This is the Illinois Center. It's a whole massive new business district. Prudential's investment is crucial. Why do they pick its location here? It's just north of Grant Park. Views in perpetuity. And this was, again, very important to Prudential. Views of the building, not to get lost in the throng of skyscrapers downtown. And if you go there today and you stand at the Institute of Art in Chicago, although there are many other buildings behind it, you can still see the Prudential building right there. The Chicago project gave Prudential the confidence to tackle an even more complicated project in Boston. Now, again, very quickly, there are key precedents here in terms of the city within the city here. They are looking back to Rockefeller Center for so many of these projects, and also the projects like the Cleveland Terminal Tower complex from 1930, which brought together so many functions of the city. These become precedents for the Chicago building, but then especially for the Prudential Center here in Boston, where they would likewise think about combining many different elements of the city, hotels, shopping, office space, transportation facilities in one place. And they would be keeping that in mind, and especially their experience in Chicago, when they came to Boston to deal with this property, the Boston Albany Railroad Yards, and made their announcement, as they did in 1957, Carol Shanks, the Mayor John Hines, coming to the Chamber of Commerce in Boston, making this dramatic announcement of the Prudential Center. It was like totally far out. It was like nothing anyone in Boston had ever seen. A scale unlike they'd ever seen, an aesthetic unlike anything that was out there. A totally new landscape dropped right here in the Back Bay. Again, Prudential had purchased this property in a private transaction with the railroad yard, and they wanted to then move forward and advance this project. Now, why was this so important to Boston in 1950? Boston is on the eve of urban renewal at this time. Cities like Boston are genuinely concerned that the urban fabric, the built environment of their town, is not going to cut it. It is literally obsolete. It can no longer house the businesses and the economic functions of the post-war city. And it needs to be gutted. It needs to be modernized. It needs to be remade. Now, for us, our eyes, we've come back again, haven't we? I mean, I think many of us, we look at the dense city of this time and all those buildings, man, how interesting, how wonderful, all of the great buildings there, these streets, these places. The planners, the politicians, the corporate executives had precisely the opposite view. Old, congested, worn out, we gotta fix it. We need to bring in something new. And Boston would begin to implement the policies of urban renewal and urban redevelopment at this time. And let me say this. Let me see if my next slide is going to help me say it. Sometimes I forget what's happening. It's coming up next. Let me see here. Where's my next slide? Okay, right. Boston is concerned for another reason. The question is, how is it going to reinvent itself as an important economic engine? Now, bear this in mind. There is industrial activity and important economic activity happening in Boston in the 1950s, but it's not happening in the city. It's happening in the suburbs. It's happening along the new piece of infrastructure, Route 128, which is coming online in the middle of the 1950s, and the new industrial parks and the high-tech industries that are locating around it. So when Prudential, this is one of their internal magazines, proposes this kind of landscape that went through many iterations, as I'll show you, for this spot, they're not just thinking about Boston, they're thinking about the region. They have that kind of scope. Boston presents many opportunities for them to make these kinds of investments across the region. That's what they're thinking of at that time. And again, cities are concerned. Okay, good, stay there. Cities are concerned. They're concerned because some very important companies like Connecticut General, as we've seen, said, forget about the city. We're going to the suburbs and building a whole new place out there. And downtown, in so many cities like Hartford, cities would begin to advance urban redevelopment projects to make the same opportunities for new landscapes that were so easily available in the green fields of the suburbs, okay? Here's the point. All of that cluttered buildings downtown, you couldn't house a new big investment like you could out in the suburbs. So what do cities do? They make them. They clear them. They clear the sites. And they use the Housing Acts of 49 and 54 to do it. Now let me just quickly say, so while this is going on in the suburbs, Hartford clears the Front Street area, basically a Little Italy kind of area in Hartford, and builds Constitution Plaza. Who is the patron of Constitution Plaza? It's the Travelers Insurance Company, which was, in some sense, had fixed capital in downtown Hartford with their big tower there. They see this project floundering, and they step in to fill the breach to do it. This is an important theme here, that insurance companies more often, time and time again, are stepping in to become the chief patrons of the urban redevelopment landscapes in the center of cities. The key example for this was in Pittsburgh, where the Equitable Insurance Company steps in to build this new office and park landscape with new highway infrastructure along the sides on what had been the kind of industrial tip of Pittsburgh's Peninsula Center. All of this railroad infrastructure and kind of a mixed-use industrial warehousing area swept clean and remade as a clean white-collar landscape sponsored by the insurance company. In Boston, again, we begin to see the implementation of these policies, just as they had in Pittsburgh and just as they had in Hartford, too, based on the U.S. Housing Acts of 49 and 54. Now, what these acts are supposed to do is to say, if your cities have slums or blight, we're going to give you money to help clear it. What they don't do so much is help you figure out what to build in its place. And this becomes a major problem in a lot of cities, which is a kind of double blight. You would clear the one blight only to replace it with empty lots without necessarily knowing what would come in to fill it. So the two key projects of the kind of clearance era of redevelopment in Boston are the New York Streets area. This is South Station right off here. This whole part of the town, which was, again, built by the railroads in the first place. And, of course, the West End area out here. Those were the kind of first halting efforts of Boston to implement these projects. Now, when Prudential comes in 57 and announces their own project, Boston immediately gets a kind of kick in the pants in terms of new projects in the city. Who steps in? It's insurance companies, as we might predict. Travelers, in 1959, this building is now gone, builds a branch office in Boston right on the side of the Central Artery. And Blue Cross Blue Shield, a building that's been threatened more recently by Paul Rudolph, is constructed also. These are more the kind of traditional central business districts. So even Prudential's announcement is beginning to spur economic activity in the city. But there would be bumps in the road, two significant bumps in the road. And while these were being worked out, there was a pond on the site. Now, let me make this clear. The two bumps in the road are this. One, Prudential is competing in the first place with the Mass Pike for the rail yard. because the Pike wants it to build their extension into the city. They began as rivals, and they ended up teaming up and working as partners. And the second was Prudential insisted on a tax break. They weren't willing to go forward with this project without guarantees that they wouldn't be taken advantage of, in their mind, by some sort of unfair tax assessment, which Boston was famous for going back to the Curley days, James Michael Curley. So even after they start the building the foundations and they start creating what would become the Prudential Center, in 1961 they turn off, in 1960 they turn off the dewatering pumps and they flood the site. And for almost 2 years we have a Prudential pond, or Lake Prudential on it. And of course the contractors went there, you know, religiously, and they're documenting the pond. The construction photographs aren't happening. As a kind of publicity stunt, a vice president rows around with his secretary, and this is where my office should be, but it's not, putting pressure on Boston to work out how to get them a tax break. Now there is a model for figuring out how to do this that had been used by many different states. State urban redevelopment law that were designed to incentivize specifically insurance companies, though not exclusively, to invest in different urban redevelopment projects, usually housing. The key example of that is Stuyvesant Town in New York, which is built by MetLife in 1944. Now, I put together in one slide what is an entire chapter in the book, which is Prudential figuring out how to get its tax break in Boston by rewriting urban redevelopment law in Massachusetts, Chapter 121A. And I'll just very briefly take you through it. James Michael Curley, in some ways, represented the old guard of being sort of the mayor of the neighborhoods and the mayor of the poor that would get as much tax as he possibly could out of central Boston downtown business properties. Kind of fostering an adversarial relationship between government of the people and the fat cats that own real estate downtown and the big companies. When Prudential comes in with its project, we're now in a new age of John Hines, a new mayor, a new progressive mayor that wants to work with the business community to help save the city of Boston, which no longer has the luxury of having a kind of insecure tax environment, but now needs to do whatever it can to encourage investment in the central city for fear that the city will no longer become relevant in this new post-war metropolitan landscape. So they finally rewrite the law, 121A, with the Prudential project specifically in mind, pass it, and now Prudential is able to redevelop the rail yard as an urban redevelopment company, redeveloping the land in the public interest. It is in the public interest to turn an old rail yard into a new office landscape. It is in the public interest to create new infrastructural improvements like the ring roads and the highways and the parking lots and the public spaces. So they roll out the red carpet for Prudential, and Prudential gets its tax break. The second is the Turnpike. Now again, Callahan is the key figure, William F. Callahan, the chairman of the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority, who had also been chairman of the Department of Public Works, had helped build Route 128. By 1950, opening in 1955 or so, Callahan had figured out how to build his highway from the New York border all the way to Route 128. But he's got that dotted line. How can he drive his highway all the way into the heart of Boston? Now, Callahan also, in his own way, believed that this, for the city of Boston to succeed, it needed highway access. He really thought that. He really thought that if Boston weren't connected by a highway, it would itself disintegrate. It needed to be connected to the new network, the emerging network of interstate highways. And his key contractor, one of them, Perini, makes this cartoon. Some folks know more than others where, when, how to build a road. How, when, where to, now. Here's the Turnpike Pilgrim having to rear up, halt his horse at Route 128 because the turnpike ends. How to get into the city? Well, the path is right before his eyes. The Boston and Albany Railroad has a ready-made right-of-way into the city. It's a right-of-way that goes right through the rail yard that Prudential had bought in order to build its project. At first, it seemed like they were going to be mutually exclusive, but ultimately, they team up and they say, hey, we'll give you an easement through the site, that's what Prudential says, we'll build ramps right here, essentially creating a suburban-style interchange right in the back bay, feeding the parking lots. And there you have Callahan and Fred Smith, Prudential's chief negotiator, dropping the tower right on top of the pipe. So Prudential and the Pike have come to their agreement. But Callahan has another problem on his hands, and that is John Volpe. John Volpe will become governor in 1961, just as the Pike and the Prude project is beginning to advance. Now, Callahan, of course, has his own kind of issues in terms of patronage and corruption, like so many of these figures at that time. And Volpe, in some sense, is representing a way, a new way, a kind of clean way. And what Volpe wants to do is build along the 1948 Master Highway Plan, which calls for an inner belt, and that's Star Drive right there, and some several other highways like the Southwest Expressway that weren't built. But this is the plan from 1948 that Volpe, who had worked for Eisenhower as the first federal highway administrator after 56, say, we should build not a turnpike, but freeways. See, after 1956, the argument for toll roads becomes much more difficult one to make because the federal government is giving all this money, 90 cents on the dollar, to build not turnpikes, but freeways. And that's what Volpe wants to build. Now, to make another long story short, Volpe essentially backs off in the end. And the reason why is because Prudential project is hanging in the balance. Volpe and Callahan are clashing. They're clashing for several years, actually. Callahan saying, you'll never get all the federal funds. Volpe saying, your turnpike extension is going to screw up transportation planning for the whole area. We should build it along this rational plan using federal dollars. And Prudential is saying, listen, if you guys can't figure out your own internal squabbles, we're getting out of here. And because the project had already been designed and engineered around a turnpike easement, Volpe essentially says, he cries uncle. Because Prudential had become a kind of sacred cow politically. To lose Prudential's investment would have been devastating for so many politicians and so many business and political elites in the town. And so Volpe backs off, and Callahan gets the plunger. He says, I wish my opponents were on that ledge. And he ends up building the turnpike to connect Boston to Chicago without a stoplight. And these become those landscapes. In fact, some of the most devastating aspects of this are happening in my hometown of Newton, where big sweeping highway ramps in West Newton and Newton Corner wipe out big swaths of what had been neighborhoods in those places. In fact, the biggest objectors to the turnpike were residents of Newton. And then past the turnpike towards Central Artery, there's the big interchange where Copley Place would be dropped in. Okay. Now, to talk a little bit about design, really as we kind of wind down here on the back slope here, talking about the place itself. Designing the Prudential Center, making the Prudential Center. Many of the basic concepts of the Prue from the start never changed, although the look of it and the content of it went through many different iterations. It would always have a ring road. It would always have these public plazas, a hotel and convention center. The city of Boston was going to contribute the convention center, although actually Prudential ended up giving a significant grant towards building that as well. And shopping and stores and housing, too. These were always going to be residential towers. Now, Prudential and the architects they eventually worked with, Luckman and Pereira, and then Luckman and also the local firm of Hoyle, Domer, and Berry, which were themselves Ralph Adams Cram's firm, so they worked with a local architect that had experience doing insurance buildings, were not the first to consider building on the rail yard site. In fact, in 1954, the developer Roger Stevens was thinking about this as an urban redevelopment project and hired some distinguished Boston-based architects to generate a plan, led by Gropius, who was at the GSD at Harvard, Belusky, who was at MIT, and several other architects who would become well-known. And they imagined the Back Bay Center there on the same site in Boston with essentially the same program, but a different arrangement of buildings and a more internal mall here as opposed to the open plazas that were originally built with the Prudential Center. Now, this was not built, of course. And there's a question, actually, as to whether or not, had this been built, would the Prudential Center have been better received? Would it have been considered good? Would it have been more welcome when it had initially been built? It's hard to say, because in some ways, the modernist architecture, had this been built, was equally oriented to the automobile, was equally about plazas away from the street. In other words, it might have been subject to the same critiques that were leveled at the Prudential Center. And what I'd like to argue is this. Because Prudential didn't work with this plan, they ended up with a place that ended up being more resilient, that actually allowed itself to be redeveloped over the years to become the place that it is today. I'm going to come back to this point. But Prudential didn't want to work with Gropius and Belusky. They didn't want to work with these academic eggheads that were modernists, that might advance their own agenda, had their own very strong ideas about what architecture was supposed to look like. Prudential wanted to work with a businessman, someone who they could really relate to, someone like Charles Luttman. Again, reviewing Pereira's designs, Pereira always wearing his smock for these publicity photos, Luttman always with the pipe in his mouth. They wanted to work with people that they could relate to as other business people that cared about the bottom line more than anything else. Luttman, very quickly, had an impressive career in business before he came to the business of architecture. He was the president of Lever Brothers, which had been based in Cambridge, actually, so people in Boston knew him from that. He decided to pick up and build Lever House on Park Avenue to house the center of this the American node of this empire of soap. And although this was designed by Gordon Bunshaft and Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, Luttman would forever take credit for it. It was his idea to open up the building to the street, to let people walk right into that plaza on the street level. Luttman would not admit that anyone else but he had come up with the idea. But he left Lever, actually before this building was erected, and was coaxed to return to architecture. He had trained as an architect before business, and he goes to California to join with William Pereira. Now, Luttman is... That's it, that's good, okay. Just a few more minutes now. We're right on time. Fantastic. Luttman, again, is one of the most prolific architects of his age, and yet many of the buildings are not considered very good. He's known for big planning projects, like Los Angeles Airport. You might even think that tower looks a little bit like a mini Peru, doesn't it? He designed Mission Control for NASA over in Houston. They did the master planning for this. They designed corporate office towers in cities all across the United States, and they designed Madison Square Garden in New York City, also another rail yard project. He wrote a biography from Soap to Skyscrapers. He really was a kind of public figure. He sells architecture the way he sold soap in bulk, I guess is maybe what they were alluding to there, and he was always known for more of a businessman than really a designer. But listen, Luttman was no intellectual slouch. He had ideas about design, and he wrote about them. The architect as designer. He gave many speeches on it, and he said, well, what is the architect but a designer? No. The architect, for Luttman, is managing the whole process of building, but let him not forget about design too. So he's reminding people that one of the functions of the architect is actually to design as well. When he came to Boston, he wanted to do the same thing that Lever House did. He wanted to open it up and create these impressive plazas, places for people to gather. He wanted to humanate the center. Now, this is a little bit of an awkward construction, sort of humiliation, annihilation. Somewhere in the middle there, he's going to humanate it to make this a place for humans to really live and to enjoy the city. This is what they were thinking about at that time. They weren't thinking about the mixed-use street. The street was dirty. The street was congested. They wanted these new places to ennoble the pedestrian, to let he and she really walk through the city with some dignity away from the sooty street of the old industrial city. So let's humanate the city. It turns out that the plazas were slightly awkward gestures of this civic largesse. They never really worked, did they? They were never comfortable places to go shopping. And even when the tower was filled with tenants, and even when the housing was extremely desirable, and even when the auditorium was booked for years to come, they couldn't figure out a way to get the retail plazas to work. Surrounded as they were by a moat, people were being blown into the moat, there were wind problems. It was a disaster, okay? And part of this is that Luttman, again, the archives that I found for Luttman for this book, they're business archives. It's really about making architecture not as leaps of inspiration at the drafting table, but as hammering out a bureaucratic process. And the memos back and forth between the architect and the engineers and the subcontractors and the clients this is really how the building got made, more than some sort of brilliant design concept. And yet they did want the building to be lacy. And the architect said one thing over and over again, because, you know, in some sense, the Prue is a kind of ugly duckling. We like the facade of the Prue. We wouldn't really want it any other way. They considered reskinning it, but they didn't. The idea was to make it lacy and textured. But of course it was maligned. Good and bad. This was mostly the bad. The building itself as a piece of architecture, and also urbanistically, it was bad because it rejected the street. Already by the mid to late 60s, ideas about urban redevelopment had shifted. So something planned in the late 50s was now viewed in the mid-60s as a kind of mistake, a kind of anti-urbanism at that time. But again, it was part of the New Boston, paired with the Government Center, where many of the architects spurned by Prudential ended up making projects. Gropius, this is Paul Rudolph, and others. And Boston becomes this amazing place where you can step, as it still is, step from the 18th century or even before into the 20th, and now, of course, the 21st. It was done. And Perini's there to congratulate them. Magnificent Center sparked the New Boston. And in their own understated way, Hancock, the local insurance company, says, "A toast to the new Prudential Center. Here's looking at you." And just a little bit later, they would literally they say, "We can't let these outsiders outshine us." And they end up hiring, again, architects with distinction, the firm of Paik, Cobb, and Fried, to design their kind of prismatic mirrored facade, which is also well known for some of those mirrors crashing to the floor. But putting that aside, it becomes a kind of foil, doesn't it, for the proof. But these are my last slides. The legacy of the Prudential Center is confidence in Boston as a leading city of the post-industrial economy. And look, it has. Boston today continues to be a place where the post-industrial economy, meds and eds, as we say in city planning, make Boston an extremely or relatively successful and desirable place. So we have all the problems with that, don't we? We have problems with equity, with the just distribution of all of the wealth that's in Boston, don't we? And we have problems with displacement and gentrification. But let me say this. In some ways, those are good problems to have. They're luxurious problems to have because they're a sign that Boston has made it in the post-war hierarchy of the service economy. Buffalo would kill to have some of the problems of displacement that Boston has. So this is interesting to think about when we talk about gentrification and displacement today. And after the Prue comes into place, the city would begin to boom with a whole series of new towers, the federal government bracketing it in 1977 with the Federal Reserve and, of course, the Government Center here, but also our local banks and others begin to build fiduciary trust. Shawmut, the Christian Science Church, gets into the act, one of the neighbors there, and the rest of it. I argue in the book that Prue's investment was crucial and turning the page for Boston to be seen in that way as a good place to invest. Now, when the Copley Place comes to town, it really is proof that Prudential had kind of failed as a place to shop, because this was now a new interior mall, and there was a skyway that would deliver you to a windswept plaza. Now, I'm not going to talk about the whole remaking of the Prue, although we can talk about it in the question-answer period for a little bit, but what it is today is almost unrecognizable from the way it was in 65 and even as late as 1980. But by the mid-80s, once Copley Place was there, Prudential planners start saying, "We've got to fix this." And they begin a process still happening today of infill, of creating an interior arcade and shopping center that you all know, and of rebuilding the streetscape. So the fact that there was all these awkward places, the humanation represented here, turned out to be the opportunity here to make the Prudential Center so integrated into the Back Bay, as in some ways that it is, although we can debate that too. Another legacy is every major project in Boston goes through the BRA. The BRA runs the public process for all of these, as it did in the case of the Prudential Center too. That was one of the stipulations of 121A. There had to be a public process through the BRA. So the new towers projected for Copley Square, Back Bay with Liberty Mutual, and South Station Tower will all be filtered through the BRA. And finally, when I'm not in New Haven, I live just a few steps away from this new project, the Barclay Center in Brooklyn, another controversial railroad project for a lot of different reasons. And if I were to, one of them is because they used eminent domain to clear it. And it's controversial, too, because they're getting all of these kinds of breaks and subsidies, not unlike in its way the ones that Prudential got. So if I could talk to Bruce Stratner, here's what I would say, the developer. I say, be like Prudential. Limited dividend. If you're going to accept money from public subsidies of any kind, you're not allowed to take all the profit in the world. You're only allowed to take a certain amount. Make it limited dividend the way the Prudential did, and it is a kind of sign of good faith. So listen, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for sticking with me here and to talk about insuring the city, the remaking of Boston and the American city in the post-war period. Thank you so much for your attention.